Thank you, Juan. It's good to be with you this morning and to have an opportunity to study the Bible together with you, and I know that's why you're here. If you're visiting, we appreciate you being here and hope that your purpose is the same as ours. I appreciate Wally's prayer so much. It was good for me because he really focused on God, and God is the center of everything, and that's really what this assembly is about. It's not about us. It is about Him, and we are here to honor Him because He's the only one who deserves honor. And so this morning we're going to think a little bit about God in our study, and but we are going to talk about how He does allow us to be a part of His program. And to that degree, that's to His honor and glory too, because certainly we are unworthy of that. And it's amazing. What is so amazing is that He's able to take such unamazing and unworthy people and use us. And so our services this morning as we're together is not some ritual where we're going through motions, but we are the unworthy that has come before the only one who is worthy, and we are trying to express our gratitude to Him for what He's done through us. But we are going to zero in on a particular person this morning. I chose Moses for our study. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at Pharaoh and saw how God glorified Himself in Pharaoh. Through Pharaoh's stubbornness, He showed His glory to the world. But the other principal character of the book of Exodus is Moses. God chose him. And if I can borrow him and his life this morning, I'm going to try to use that to talk a little about what I call God's leadership development program. I don't think I've done any lesson here on leadership development, at least not that I can remember. And again, Moses is not really the center of this. Really, God is the center. And Moses is just a figure. He's just an instrument through which God achieved His purposes. But I think we can learn some good lessons in this as we look at his life, and see how God is able to take someone and develop him and use him to serve him in his plan. I do want to mention, just as an aside, that I forgot to get to Eric, which is typically my, I don't ever seem to get to him with the announcements I'm supposed to get to the announcer, but my family's not with me this morning, and all four of my kids are sick. So if I didn't mention that, I'd feel bad about that later. So please keep them in your prayers, as they're all, the kids are all sick today. His story really begins before he was even born. It begins in the setting of Egypt, as we know. If you want to look in your Bibles to Exodus, the second chapter. And what's neat is just to see that God does not require perfect and ideal settings from which He can develop great men. In fact, maybe the worst of times, when everything is completely hopeless and dark, and is the best time for God to do it, because it brings more and more honor to Him, that He doesn't require perfect conditions. But the certain conditions were certainly far from that. In this setting, chapter 1, let's read, I said 2, but let's read chapter 1, verse 13 through 16, just for a sample. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the field, and all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. And the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra, and the other was named Pua, and he said, "When you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then shall put him to death, but if it is a daughter, then she shall live." So the setting from which God is going to raise up this man is certainly far from what we would consider an ideal setting. It's a situation of darkness and oppression and hopelessness, 400 years of hopelessness. And what's just amazing to me, and this is not our lesson really, but is how God, the very edict that Pharaoh gives, is the catalyst that begins a series of events through which God is going to raise up his leader for these Israelites, his Redeemer. And so they're not expecting, you wouldn't expect good things to happen from this. It looks like the worst case scenario. But somehow God is going to be able to take this and turn it around and use it for his purposes. But what I think certainly contributed at least to what is going to Moses becoming what he is that his parents, the kind of parents he had, their names were Amram and Jochebed. You might remember that. And one of the things that we learn in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 6 through 10 is how much God treasured him, this young man, and how much the parents treasured him. And it says when she opened it, she saw a child, and behold, the boy. This is after Moses was born. And you might remember in Acts chapter 7 and verse 20, it says he was lovely in the sight of God. And in Acts Hebrews 11, 23, he was beautiful in his parents' eyes. And they hid him for 3 months in their home. But after that, they put him in a basket, remember, and they sent him down a river. And he was found by this princess, which is a story in and of itself. Just the amazing sequence of events shows that there had to be the providence of God in this whole process. But it says in verse 6, when she opened it, talking about this daughter of Pharaoh, that she saw a child, behold, a boy was crying. She had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. His sister took Pharaoh's daughter, or his sister, Miriam, who had been watching nearby, said to the Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go ahead. And so the child went and called the child's mother. And the daughter of Pharaoh said, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. And so here's, what we know the story that through God's providence, that even, the mother of Moses was able to come and to take care of him. And certainly, as you think about that, you think about these are devoted parents. They're devoted to God. They didn't give up. They didn't decide that this was not, God hasn't shown himself for 400 years. Why should, we show devotion to him now and put our necks on the line? In fact, they're selfless parents. They risk everything here. They didn't fear what was happening if they were caught. They didn't think, we've got other children to think about. We have, we have Aaron and we have Miriam and we need to take care of them. I don't really know how many years it would be until Jochebed even came back home, or if she was able to go back and forth between Pharaoh's palace and her home with her husband and her other two children. But they risked everything for him. They were selfless parents. And she must have also been diligent. She was a diligent parent, I feel. When we look at Acts 7, verse 23, it said at a certain age it came to Moses' mind to go and visit his brethren. Well, how would he have known that? How would it have entered his mind to visit his brethren if somebody didn't put in his mind who his brethren were? And so this woman did, I think, what all Hebrew parents were supposed to do, is they taught him. She taught him when he was young. We'll read Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4 and 5, where it says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and all your might. And then he says, These words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and talk to them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. So I would suspect that this mother was fairly diligent to put into the heart of her son, in the time that she was given to take care of him, the words and the truths of God's word. Imagine what kind of circumstances like that would have, bolstered your initiative and caused you to feel more frantic, more determined, more, to get this material into him, because you just didn't know how long that you would have, or you didn't know how long it would be before the culture of the the Egypt and the influence of the palace and all of that around would overwhelm him, and you would be so eager to influence him as much as you could. And it is kind of interesting. I never thought about this before, but you know, Jochebed could have abandoned God to live it up in the palaces. I mean, she could have rationalized, you know. It has been 400 years. You know, how do we know that God's going to do anything? Why should I? Here I am. I've been given this cushy situation in the palace. Why don't I just, you know, enjoy the riches of Egypt? So she could have, you know, taken that kind of approach. You know, I don't know when they were separated, Moses from his mother. But, you know, I don't think we can underestimate the significance of getting into a child's heart the scriptures at a young age. We just always can. We just assume there'll be so much. There'll be time for that later. We assume that there will, and then as soon as our kids, as our culture deems it so healthy, to get them into schools as soon as possible and separate them from their parents as long periods of time as possible. And what do they have for 90% of the day? They're influenced by the culture that we live in, which is just as corrupt, and the schools are just as corrupt as Egypt was. But this woman filled her son as quickly as she could. And certainly that had to is an influence on that parents should, his parents was able to have, and contributed to making him the man that he turned out to be. Well, Moses' life is sort of divided up into three different periods for us, conveniently, into 40-year segments. It talks about the first 40 years and the second 40 years and the third 40 years. So there's my three points real quick that I want you to look with me at. And we'll look in Acts chapter 7, where Stephen gives some commentary on the life of Moses when he was indicting the Jewish aristocracy of his day for rejecting all of God's deliverers that he had sent to them. And in this, he talks about Moses as one of those deliverers. And in chapter 7, let's read just a little bit. Chapter 7, verse 22. And Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, it says. And he was a man of power in words and in deeds. But when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. So we get a little snippet, just a little commentary, something about Moses for the first 40 years of his life and what his education had done for him. And he was a very wise man and learned a lot in all the Egyptian education, and he was powerful in words and in deeds. And kind of, you know, to me, it raised the question at one point, you know, at this point, I thought, he doesn't show a whole lot of promise at this point, because for 40 years, he hasn't done anything. I think, when I think about a 40-year-old, I think about a guy that's kind of getting on up there. Not really, but, I mean, you know, he's 40 years old. He ought to have been mature a long time before that. Why did he wait 40 years to do anything? Maybe he was enjoying life as a prince. I mean, he was in line. I don't know if he was in line to inherit the throne. Sometimes people say he would be Pharaoh one day. I don't know if that's true or not. But he certainly is in a nice, cushy position there in the prince. And so maybe he feared oppression. Maybe he feared opposition that would come as for going to associate with the Hebrews. There's certainly a lot to sacrifice there. He's not going to be able to benefit from his wisdom. There's no personal advantage and benefit from his wisdom and his talents and his power to live among a bunch of slaves. What's that going to do for him? And ultimately, he hadn't made his parents' principles his own principles. You know, the courage to act comes from conviction. And maybe Moses, until he was 40, had not made all those things he had taught truly his own personal principles. You know, you ever been that way? You grow up, I mean, some of us who had parents who were Christians, and we grew up in a congregation listening to preaching, and we knew the truth. I mean, you can quote the Bible from the age you're 7, 8, 9, 10, and that's great. And I encourage that. I think we ought to fill our kids up and have them quoting the Bible. But you know, until you take that truth and you make it your own personal truth, it's just knowledge. Knowledge without, it hasn't any power in your life. Maybe for Moses, it took him 40 years before it ever came to become to bear some fruit. But about the age of 40, it says, and that he came to see this, he encountered this oppressive situation, verse 24. He entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel, and when he saw one of them being mistreated or treated unjustly, he defended him. He took vengeance upon for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And then he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they didn't understand. So he sees this oppressed situation. He moves to take vengeance. Maybe he's been sheltered from all that oppression until now. I don't know. Maybe that's the first time he's ever seen what goes on with the Hebrew people. And he kind of goes a little bit overboard here. He kills this man, kills the Egyptian, and he sort of thinks at the moment that he's going to be the one to be the deliverer of the people. I mean, he's going to take leadership into his own hands. Made sense to him. You know, I could see why he might reason that. So he kind of makes himself, I think, kind of like a self-appointed deliverer here of God's people. And he sort of learns that quickly that doesn't always work. In verse 25 it says, he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they didn't understand. And on the following day he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace and said, men, you are brethren, why do you injure one another? But one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away and said, who made you a ruler and judge over us? You didn't mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you? And then at this remark, Moses fled. So maybe this is like zeal without knowledge. Moses senses that he needs to do something, take a stand, take courage, but it doesn't go the way he planned it. He doesn't turn out to be the deliverer that he thought maybe he was hoping to be. But what we can see, I think, is that seed that was planted long ago that's starting to grow in his heart. That those principles are starting to take root in his heart. And some things here happen to Moses that must happen in the life, it seems like, of any leader or one who wants to be a leader among God's people. Hebrews chapter 11, if you want to look over there, has more commentary on what happened here about this point in Moses' life. Hebrews chapter 11, 24 to 27. It says, by faith, this is verse 24, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. So I'd suggest the first thing is that he renounces worldly advantages. He gives up the thing that gives him a great personal advantage, the status that he has. And that was necessary before he was able to become a good leader. The second thing in verse 25 says, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of the passing pleasures of sin. So he denies himself personal pleasures. He is going to choose injustice. So he's denying the opposite of that. He's not going to pamper himself with pleasures like he has up to this point. He's denying himself. He's accepting the opposite. Injustices. And then the last thing is he begins to look to the unseen rather than to the seen. In verse 26, he said, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking for the reward, and by faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who was unseen. So he sort of gets a vision, a bigger vision than just what's in front of his eyes. You know, I can imagine living in that palace and seeing and having all the luxuries and all the things that are right before me and not being able to see beyond that. That's there. This is life. This is living right here. Look at what I have and look at how this serves me so well. And this is a reward. This is what is real, true life, what it's about. But now he's casting his eyes beyond. He's going to look at the unseen, at the invisible God, at a reward, a potential reward that he doesn't have in his hands right now. And isn't that something that's necessary for someone to be able to be a leader? That we can't live in the moment and just live for what you can see right in front of your nose. But a leader has to have vision of something bigger and something farther away that he's got to go toward. And in this case, you know, that'll challenge Moses all of his life. He's going to have to lead a people out of Egypt and across a desert into a land that they've never been to before. And he's going to have to, you know, he is going to be trying his best to keep their heads raised up, looking for something that they can't see. And that seems to be a kind of a principle that follows all the way, you know, through the Bible with Abraham, who leaves the Ur of the Chaldees and goes to a land that he doesn't even know where he's going. That God, you know, sends you on this journey, and you have to walk not according to what you see, because anything you see is gonna argue completely against the direction you're going. But you have to see what is unseen. You have to look toward the unseen. And so Moses begins this formation of these. You know, he makes a personal conviction. He takes these principles he was taught years before, and he begins to swallow them down and put them in his heart, and they begin to live in his life as sort of a personal conviction. And I think that's where, you know, it's critical that faith becomes personal. He's not doing it for mom and dad. He's not doing it, you know, because mom and dad are watching over his shoulder. But it comes from something deep down in his heart. It's Moses and God now. And that's what it's going to have to be. I thought it was encouraging to see that 40 years old is not too old to make a decision. That, you know, God is patient and he waited for him. And some of us maybe need to make that decision. Maybe we're 40 years old. Maybe you haven't made a decision. And maybe you think you're too old. But Moses was a slow starter. And maybe you have Bible knowledge. Maybe you know a lot of stuff. But maybe you haven't made that a personal faith like Moses did when he came to that age and began to devote himself wholly to God. 40 years old is not too old. So there's the first third of Moses' life as he decided to record, or the Spirit had him record it for us. But there's another 40 years, too, to go. And look back to Acts chapter 7. We'll read a couple of verses there that sort of summarizes the next 40 years of his life. Again, this is the idea of making a leader. Don't lose the theme of our studies, the making of a leader. Chapter 7, verse 29 and 30. After he flees from Egypt, and it says, and this, at this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. And after 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in the flame of a burning bush. So Moses flees to Midian, which is, I guess, on the western side of the Sinai Peninsula. And he arrives there we don't have time really to read it all, but he sort of rescues the damsel in distress. He some shepherds, encounters these shepherds, and he helps this woman water her the flock that she's come to water back in Exodus chapter 2. And this woman's father happens to be the priest there in Midian. And the story down in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 19, she says, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and what's more, he even drew water for us and watered the flock. And so, you know, the father invites him in, and he gives this woman to Moses as a wife. And she bears him two sons. The first son that's mentioned here is in verse 22. This is Exodus chapter 2 and verse 22. His name is Gershom. And it says, he names him that because it means, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. It just kind of struck me, you know, that 40 more years have passed now. Moses arrives in Midian. He has this encounter with this family. And he is given a wife, and he lives in Midian for 40 more years before God will contact him and meet him at the mountain and give him his commission. And I saw, you know, God leaves him there for 40 long years in Midian. I mean, don't you think that, why would he leave Moses there for 40 years and then wait another 40 years to deliver the people in Israel, in Egypt? I mean, they would certainly have appreciated somebody coming to get him out 40 years before. But they have to wait another 40 years. And I want to just suggest some things. First of all, Moses had to learn to be a shepherd before he could lead people. He had to learn what it meant not to have a place called home and to live in the fields. And he went sort of from rags to riches, from a palace to a tent. And that's how he's depicted, living in the in the fields. And he names his first son, Gershom, because he said, "I've become a sojourner in the land." It wasn't his land. His land was Egypt. His home was Egypt. But now he's living in this foreign land as a sojourner. He had been taken away from the security of a palace. And now he's learning what it means to trust in God. And I think he also had to learn here to sympathize with people, the people that he would lead. He learns compassion. You know, sometimes people at work will complain that their boss doesn't understand what they're going through, doesn't really know what they're suffering. That's true a lot of times. And Moses hadn't been there. He hadn't been in the pits working as a slave. And he hadn't known hard labor. And he didn't know what it meant to be an alien and a nobody, to have no identity. He had identity. If anybody had identity, it was Moses. Or at least he would have identified himself probably earlier in his life with the Egyptians. And so, you know, I think for leaders to have compassion, they need to travel the same road as those who are going to follow them. So in Midian, you have this powerful prince of Egypt who becomes a nobody. And he loses his identity. And that, think about that. That kind of, in some way, resembles God's training program for the apostles. Because Jesus had to teach his apostles, they were going to have to learn to be nobodies. They were nobodies to begin with. They were fishermen. But they wanted to be somebodies. And all they could see in their minds was this great, glorious future of being the first in the kingdom. And so Jesus had to undo that and teach them, no, until you can be first in my kingdom, you got to learn to be a nobody. And you got to lose your identity. The only identity you're going to have is in me. And that's what Moses had to learn. And that's what, before he was ready to go and get these people out. So he learns compassion, I think. And then after 40 years, God meets with him. And we want to go back to Acts chapter 7, verse 30 through 34. He meets with him and he gives him a commission. So, Acts chapter 7, 30 through 34, Moses' commission. He says, after 40 years he had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in the flame of a burning thorn bush. And when Moses saw it, he began to marvel at the sight. And as he approached to look more closely, there came a voice of the Lord. And he said, "I'm the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob." And Moses shook with fear and would not venture to look. But the Lord said to him, "Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place in which you are standing is holy ground. I've certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I've heard their groans. I've come down to deliver them. Come now, and I will send you to Egypt." So now we sort of enter into the third period of Moses' life. We've seen two periods of 40 years, and now the Bible sort of gives us the third chunk of his life, and from the age of 80 to about the age of 120. So in this period, God kind of calls him into service. This is like the commissioning of Moses. And the first thing that happens is he's going to learn to trust in God rather than learn to trust in himself. And God's going to do that by giving him a task that's far beyond his capacity to pull off on his own. And back in Exodus chapter 3, if you remember the scene after God meets him and commissions him, tells him where he's going to go, "You're going to go to Pharaoh and you're going to bring my people out." Moses' response, chapter 3 and verse 11, he says, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" And God says, "I'll be with you, and I'll take care of that for you." But down in chapter 4 and verse 1, Moses answered and says, "Well, what if they won't believe me or won't listen to me or to what I say? For they may say," you know, now he's concerned about Israel, that they're not going to listen to him. And he says, "You know, what if they won't listen to me? And they may say, the Lord's not appeared to you." And then so the Lord gives him some signs to work, and gives him some evidence, some proof. But then in verse 10, Moses is pretty persistent. He says to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither recently nor in times past, nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, for I'm a slow of speech and I'm slow of tongue." And God gets kind of put out with him about that time. He says, who made your tongue? You know, I'm the one that made it. I can use your tongue whenever I want. He says, "Well, just please send Moses instead. Can you just, or please send Aaron?" And God says, "Okay." He kind of condescends. He says, "All right, I'll let you take Aaron with you." And But you know what's interesting is that he doesn't let him quit. This assignment, you know, going back to this idea of learning to trust in God rather than himself, being given a task that was way beyond what Moses had the capacity to pull off. You know, this was part of God's eternal purpose. It was not about Moses. God was not relying on Moses. He wasn't relying on his talents. He wasn't relying on his abilities. And sending someone who wasn't qualified really served perfectly to magnify God's power. It wouldn't have been quite the same, would it, if he had sent Moses, or he had waited until Moses became Pharaoh and then had him have the people released. But he stripped Moses of all of his dignity, he stripped him of his power, and then he sends him to do the job. And so Moses is going to have to learn to trust God in this instead of trusting himself. And he's going to have to also learn to not only do that, he's going to have to learn to accept to rejection. He's going to have to learn to accept what it means to be rejected as a leader. It'd be kind of naive for us to think that everybody's going to welcome our efforts, especially when they are going to run counter to conventional wisdom. And people had rejected Moses' efforts even from the outset when he tried to rescue him before God called him. But it doesn't stop there. After he brings Israel out of Egypt, and they go out into the wilderness, they never stop complaining. That's one of the key emphasis of Exodus later on is how many times that these people complain to Moses. And by the end of 2 years, look over with me to Numbers chapter 11. I'm kind of jumping ahead here because of time. But even by the end of Numbers chapter 11, Moses is sort of fed up with us, because they complained and rejected him so many times. Numbers chapter 11 and verse 10. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, and each man at the doorway of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses was displeased. And Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you been so hard on my servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight, that thou hast laid the burden of all this people on me? Was it I who conceived all these people? Was it I who brought them forth, that thou shouldest say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries her nursing infant to the land which thou didst swear to thy father, their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give all these people? For they weep before me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. I alone am not able to carry all these people, because it is too burdensome for me. If you're going to deal with me like this, please kill me at once. For if I found favor in your sight, and don't let me see my wretchedness." Moses has kind of reached the end of his rope. He says, I am through with this. I can't take this anymore. It's not fair. You know, I didn't ask. I didn't even sign up for this thing. So why don't you just, you know, take me out? You know, but don't put me through this. I can't bear the load. And, you know, what's neat is God doesn't accept his resignation. You know, he tries to resign and God won't accept it. In fact, he says, I'll give you some help. I'll tell you what, I'll give you some help. So he puts his spirit upon 70 men, verse 16 and 17, from the elders of Israel. He said, they're going to help you out and help bear some of the load so that you can. But he doesn't let him quit. And that is a neat thing to think about. Moses is having to learn he is training him up to be a leader. And part of that is not letting somebody quit. And Moses learned obedience, I guess you could say, just like we're going to talk about with the Lord. He learned obedience through the things that he suffered. God chose patience with him. He knew Moses had been given a tough job. God knew the people were obstinate. They weren't righteous people. He didn't save them because they were righteous. He saved them because he made a promise to Abraham, so he brought them out. But not because they were good people. But he shows mercy to Moses. And he doesn't, and gives him some help. And Moses is going to learn for the next, you know, period of time I put learning obedience from the things you suffer, but he's also going to learn that leadership is about serving the needs of others instead of above your own needs. These people are ungrateful. They are unthankful to Moses for all he's done. And Moses has to spend a lot of time interceding on these people's behalf. It's amazing. You know, he could have said, you guys mistreated me. Forget you. And when God more than one time threatened to kill him, he should have said, I'm all for that. Just burn them up. Let's get another batch of people, because these are certainly not worth saving. But he pleads for them. That's one illustration in Exodus chapter 32, that where he prays for them and asks God not to destroy them. And then let's read that one prayer. Look in Exodus chapter 30, verse 30 through 34. Exodus chapter 30.
30
and
32.
Did I say it wrong? Oh, I did say it. So you're right. Is it 30? What did I write down? 32, sorry. It says, and it came about the next day that Moses said to the people, you yourselves have committed a great sin, and now I'm going to go to the Lord, and perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. And Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they made a god of gold for themselves. But now if you will forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from thy book, which thou hast written. And the Lord said to Moses, whoever sinned against me, I will blot him out from my book. But go now and lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angels will go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin. And so Moses pleads with God and asks God to spare them. And that's repeated over and over. Go through Numbers and find where he has to pray for his brother and sister when Aaron and Miriam feel like they're getting left out, and God makes Miriam into a leper, and Moses pleads on her behalf. Or when they're about to enter the promised land, and the people see that they're giants in the land, they say, we're going to stone them. We're done with these with Moses and these others. And so they're going to stone them. And God, and again, Moses goes and pleads with God not to kill them, which is he's ready to destroy the people again. And then finally in number 16, there's another rebellion that rises up with a man named Korah. And again, there's this petition. Moses begs and pleads with God. And so he learns that leadership is about serving the needs of others above his own, even those people that would work against him. And he learns that leaders are not above the law. Numbers chapter 12 and verse 20. Whenever he is because of the obstinance of the people, and they're complaining and such. You know, he asks God to provide them water, and God grants them that. Tells him to speak to a rock, and Moses, in his anger, he beats on the rock, and the water, you know, comes forth from the rock. But God says, you know, you dishonored me in front of these people. You disobeyed me, and therefore you can't go into the land of promise. And so he learns that, you know, that leadership, leaders are not above the law. They have to follow God implicitly, and that was a bad example to set before a whole nation of disregarding the details of what God had said. I think one of the neatest things that I got to mention, just because when I was looking at the intercession that Moses did, interceding for the people, that even at the end of his life, after God said, you know, you're not going in, you know, you can't do it, and that was caused or preempted by the people being complaining, that Moses prays to God and just begs him to provide them with a good leader. But he asked that, you know, somebody be given that can lead them into the land and watch over them and come in and go out among them and love the people. And that's in Numbers chapter 27. It's not something you'd usually find people doing. After somebody's mistreated you and caused you so much heartache, and even now he can't even go into the land, why would I care if these people go in the land? But he asked God in Numbers chapter 27 to provide for them a good leader that will take them in. Well, this is taking longer than I thought, but I hope that as you think about Moses and what God did with him, he trained him up and used him as an instrument through which he could glorify himself and bring his people into the land, that God follows that pattern a lot. That may not be the way he does it every time, but he follows that pattern of training people quite often, and he did it even with Jesus. We know there's a lot of parallels between Jesus and Moses. He left a place of riches to come and live with us, similar to Moses' circumstances, only certainly heaven is far different than Egypt and the palaces of Pharaoh. But he left everything that he had and came to a place that was certainly a desolate, God-forsaken land, it would have appeared in Judah, because he couldn't find very many righteous people there. He trained him up because he had him live a simple life like a shepherd. You know, Jesus came and he said, I have no place to lay my head. He lived here as a simple man who didn't have much and learned what it would be like to be an alien in a foreign land. He learned obedience from the things he suffered. And certainly Jesus faced a lot of the criticisms that Moses did. He learned to trust in God and stand alone and endure rejection, be a servant, even to the point of death. Think about this, it's important because it's practical. As a leader, God doesn't ask us to go anywhere that he hasn't gone before. And therefore, because he's been there and done this, he's full of compassion. You know, he's learned to trust God. He's learned to deal with rejection. He's learned to be a servant. And so he knows what it is when we have to walk that same path. He knows what it means. He has compassion for us. And even his role of service didn't end when he went back to heaven. But he continues to be an advocate that intercedes on our behalf. But he is greater than Moses. And he's the one that we have to listen to. Moses is not our leader. He is a great model of what a servant is. And God developed him into being a good instrument through which he could achieve his purpose with the people in the Old Testament. Jesus is the greatest model of what leadership is. And what we need to do is take our place behind him. And again, this is, you know, when we think about leadership, you know, it's God will use us. And he has the capacity to take us at wherever we are in our life and make us into something that's useful to him. But it's all to his glory. It's about him. It's not about us. It's his plan. And he's trying to save the world. And if we can just fit our life, if we can adjust our lives and our attitudes and our way of thinking to his way of thinking, and submit ourselves to him and to his rule, he can take us and use us in his great plan. Maybe you would like to be a part of that. Maybe you'd like to make God your God, make him the center of your life and everything. Jesus is the one who invites us because he says that in him is life. And if you don't have the Lord, if you don't have Jesus, then you don't have any life. You may be walking around on two feet, but you're dead. You're dead in your sins. And Jesus has come to give us life and to point us to God. He is the revelation of who he is and what he wants from us. Maybe this morning you need to make him your Savior. Make him your Lord, as we studied in Acts chapter 2 this morning. He is calling us not just to come to him to be saved, but also to submit to him and to follow him unconditionally in all details. Maybe you'd do that this morning. If you would, why don't you stand and come forward as we sing our song.